we're going to pick up where we left off on Tuesday, talking about the metric system. And I already discussed a little bit of the background of the metric system, the fact that it is a decimal system of units, which is why we use it in science. And before we actually continuing on talking about the metric system, I wanted to talk briefly about powers of 10. Because there's not a heck of a lot of math that we end up having to use in this class, but I just wanted to make sure everybody did understand how to represent powers of 10. Because the other day I listed most of the prefixes as either one with a bunch of zeros or a decimal, a bunch of zeros, and then a one. But it's much more convenient to list things in powers of 10. So for example, if I had the number 10 to the third, what would that be equivalent to? 1,000. So easy way to remember it is whatever the power happens to be, that's the number of zeros that you're going to have in between the one and the decimal point. So 10 to the third would mean 10 times 10 times 10, which is 1,000. If I went the other direction, if I had 10 to the negative 2, what is that going to be? 0.01. Because 10 to the nothing is equal to 1. So 10 to the minus 1 would mean to divide by 10, which would mean 1/10, 0.1. If you divide it by another 10, that gives us 10 to the negative 2, so that gets us 0.01. If any of you are a little bit rusty with these powers of 10, then outside of class, if you wanted to come to office hours, we could work on that. I think I had mentioned my office hours the other day, but just in case I didn't, they're going to be on Mondays from 11:30 to 12:20. Today, as well as Tuesday and Wednesday, so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they're from 1:30 to 2:20. And then on Fridays, they're going to be 9:30 to 10:20, which my office is 1214, which is right upstairs, the Science Center. If you go up the main staircase, instead of turning right to go to the labs, you just turn left. There is a door there that's locked, and that's only because there are computers on the inside that aren't otherwise tied into offices. So if that door is closed, then the extension for my phone is listed outside. All you have to do is dial it. It'll ring me in the office, and then I have a button that I can use to buzz you into the door. Then once you come into the office area here, if you take a left and go back towards the parking lot, my office is right overlooking the parking lot. So back to the metric system. We had talked about certain base units. We know that meters are what we use to measure length. Volume, I don't know if I got to. I think I might have accidentally left that out. So let's make sure we got the list here. Length is the meter, which is abbreviated M. Volume is what? Well, I just said it, actually. It's the liter, which is abbreviated capital L. Time, it's the second, which is little s. And let's see your list here. The only other one that of the list that we're going to commonly use are mass and temperature. So mass, remember that the true base unit is the kilogram instead of the gram. So K stands for kilo, which means 1,000. Lowercase g is for gram. And the last one is for temperature, which we'll talk more about later. So that is the Kelvin, which is capital K. Now, I have given you a list of prefixes. There's quite a number of metric prefixes, but we're not going to use all of them on a regular basis. So your book has certain ones that are colored in to show you which ones you're going to more frequently use. And these are the same ones I'm going to ask that you do memorize because we are going to use them frequently enough. So just to list them out again, we have mega, which is abbreviated capital M, and that would be 10 to the sixth, which is 1 million. We have kilo, which I already said is abbreviated lowercase k, so that's going to be 10 to the third. Going down to the small side, we have deci, which is abbreviated smaller d. That's 0.1 or 10 to negative 1. Centi, because we use centimeters quite a bit, lowercase c, 10 to negative 2. Milli, we also use milliliters and millimeters, so lowercase m, which is 10 to the negative 3, 1,000th. Micro. So I'm hoping that many of you have seen this symbol before. That's a lowercase Greek letter mu. That's the symbol used to represent micro, and that would be 1 millionth, 10 to negative 6. And then the last one that you need to know is nano, lowercase n, which is 10 to the negative 9th. The reason that we end up using nano is that's in the range of the size of atoms. So that's why we need something that's so terribly small. I want to introduce the concept of something known as a unit conversion factor. This topic sometimes goes by the title of dimensional analysis, which dimension means units of measure. So if we're in the U.S., you might be more familiar with using inches, but in the lab, we don't tend to use inches. And so there's a conversion factor we can use, which says that 1 inch, abbreviated IN, is equal to 2.54 centimeters. So how could we use this in converting numbers? Suppose that I tell you that an object is 9.5 inches long. What would I do in order to convert that into centimeters? Am I going to multiply or am I going to divide? So it'll be multiply, but how do you know which way to do it? Well, the unit conversion factors always work like this. What goes on top is what you want. What goes on the bottom is what you've already got. So what do you want versus what do you got, to use some inappropriate English. The reason you always put what you already have on the bottom is that units have to cancel out. So we're going to cancel inch for inch. So the only way for them to cancel is if they're on opposite sides of the fraction. So that automatically means that what we want, centimeters, is going to go up top. If we have a unit conversion factor going from inches to moles, whatever number goes with inches automatically goes with inches when we put it on the bottom of the fraction, and whatever went with the centimeters automatically goes on top. So as long as you have your units in the right place, you don't have to guess where the numbers go. And just doing that quick bit of multiplication here, we're going to get 24.13 centimeters. Reason I want to introduce unit conversion factors is if we get to it today, we're going to get the concept of a mole, which is a number just like the number dozen or pair or trio. It's a number that we use in science to represent a certain number of atoms or molecules. And there's some unit conversions involved there. So I thought I'd start with something that's more familiar, inches and centimeters, just to talk about how to do it before we start to get into something more specifically chemistry related. Now, what if we're wanting to convert between different metric units? So for example, if we have that 1 centimeter is equal to 10 to the negative 2 meters, and then we have 1 millimeter is equal to 10 to the negative 3 meters, what if we wanted to convert back and forth between centimeters and millimeters? Well, we can create our own unit conversion factors. So in fact, if I say I'm going to compare 1 centimeter to 1 millimeter, that's 10 to negative 2 meters divided by 10 to negative 3 meters. If we work that out, that ends up being the number 10. So then I can rewrite that to say that 1 centimeter is equal to 10 millimeters. And the way that I did that is I just multiplied both sides by 1 millimeter. So millimeters and millimeters would cancel out, and I'm going to be left with millimeters next to the 10 now. So you can take any pair of metric prefixes and come up with your own unit conversion factor just like this. So again, just to show a very quick example, let's say that you measure something out to be 4.75 centimeters. If I want it in millimeters, since I've got this equivalent factor here, 1 centimeter is 10 millimeters. Remember, all I have to do is make sure that the units cancel out appropriately. So centimeters is going to be on bottom because that's going to cancel out. Millimeters are left on top. The 10 automatically goes with millimeters because that's what I've got in my conversion factor. 1's going to go in the bottom, so I get 47.5 millimeters. Now, since we're talking about measurement, then we should talk about measuring areas. Because if we're measuring an area where you've got a length and a width, that means we have square units. So, for example, let's say we've got a rectangle, and one side of that is 4 inches in length, the other one is 6 inches in length. If I multiply those together, 4 inches by 6 inches, it's 24 inches square. So just like we can use squares in numbers, we can use squares in units as well. If we ever need to convert, then we got to take that into account when we're doing our cancellation. So let's suppose that I wanted to take 24 square inches like that, convert it into centimeters squared. It's not just centimeters, because centimeters would be a length of just one side. I'd have to have centimeters squared reflect the fact that I'm talking about an area. So what would I need to do in order to do this unit conversion? Yes? Which, if I wanted to take that step by step, because we got a unit conversion factor that says I've got 2.54 centimeters per inch, then I would do it twice. Because if I have inches times inches on the bottom, that's going to give me that inches squared like you said I needed. And if I have centimeters and centimeters on top, that's going to give me the centimeters squared that I wanted. Those of you who might be a little bit more comfortable with math, which I know it's not much of a joke, but I always joke that math is a four-letter word, which if English is not your primary language, think about some of the words we're not supposed to say in polite company in English, and most of those have four letters in it, which is why some people would agree that math is a four-letter word. But if you are a little bit more comfortable with math, you could simplify this expression by putting a square outside that conversion factor. It's exactly the same thing. Whichever way you want to do it is fine, but I'm just pointing out you could do it that way as well. So just to come up with an answer, 24 times 2.54 squared, if I round it off a little bit, I get 154.8 centimeters squared. Now, we're not going to talk about rounding and numbers in lecture here today, but that's one of the activities that we're doing next week in our first lab assignment, where we're supposed to be talking about measurement. So whenever we do add or multiply, subtract, divide numbers together, there's a way you're supposed to do it in science. But like I said, I'm going to skip over that today so I can focus on lecture material. So I showed an example of doing square units. The exact same thing would happen with cube units, and that would give us volume. Now, in terms of liters, it turns out that 1 centimeter cubed is the same thing as a milliliter, which, if you've ever worked in a medical environment, you might have heard of cc's before. Well, cc is just another abbreviation for cubic centimeter. So if you're supposed to give someone 2 cc's of some kind of medication, that means 2 cubic centimeters, which also means 1 milliliter. Just to give an example of using unit conversion factors, let's say that I stay in non-metric units, but I have the volume of a large box where one end of the box is 1 foot long, another is 1.5 feet, and then let's say it's 2 feet deep. If I want to find out the volume, that would be 1 foot times 1.5 feet times 2 feet, which would give me 3 feet cubed. Suppose that I wanted to put that into cubic inches instead. Then we do it the same way that I showed up above, which is I take whatever I have already got. We know that the unit conversion factor is going to have feet on the bottom then, because I got to cancel out whatever I've got already. I'll expand this out just in case you don't like exponents. Hopefully you know that there are 12 inches in a foot, so we would have 3 of these different factors because that's how we're going to get the feet to cancel out. So if I multiply all that out, 12 times 12 times 12 times 3 gives me a big number, 5184 cubic inches. So there are some sample problems in the text for dealing with using unit conversions in the metric system. Like I said, there are these, how many did they end up being? 7 of them, of these metric prefixes I do want you to memorize, which means, yes, it would be on the quiz. I do want you to know the base units we talked about as well. So does anyone have any kind of questions about what we've covered so far? Okay. So another concept introduced in this first chapter is the concept of density, which, just to talk about types of physical properties, there are what are known as intensive properties and extensive properties. And I did look over your text, but I don't remember now if it mentions these terms in the chapter. But they're important enough concept, I wanted to mention it anyways, even if it's not written in the text. So an intensive property is some sort of physical property that doesn't depend on how much stuff that you've got. That's why it's got the term intensive. So it is a physical property that does not depend on the amount of material or a substance, if you wanted to use a little more specific term. Can anybody think of an intensive property? Let's get some examples going here. Well, it turns out one of them is density, the thing we're about to talk about. So if you have water right around room temperature, if you have 1 milliliter of water, it's always going to be about 1 gram in mass. And so we'll talk about how to represent that as density in a moment. But in other words, how much stuff do you have per milliliter? If you had 5 liters of water, well, each individual milliliter is still going to have the same amount of mass of it. It doesn't matter that you happen to have more water. So that's the idea behind an intensive property. How about temperature? If I've got something at 25 degrees Celsius and another object at 25 degrees Celsius, if I put them together, they don't all of a sudden become hotter just because I got more stuff. Temperature is something that you measure independent of how much stuff that you've got. The contrast would be an extensive property. Extensive properties, that would be a physical property that does not depend. That does depend on the amount of material. So can anyone come up with some examples of physical properties that do depend on how much stuff you've got? Mass. What else? Weight, which is related to mass. Yeah. Volume. Which could also mean length or area. So with that, let me formally define what density is. Density is equal to mass divided by volume. So in other words, how much matter there is in a given amount of space. And if you notice, we have mass, which is an extensive property. We're dividing it by volume, which is an extensive property. But since the two end up being related to each other, that's how we end up with density being an intensive property. So, for example, I said earlier that if I had 1 milliliter of water, it's going to have a mass of 1 gram. So the density would equal to 1 gram, that's its mass, over 1 milliliter, which is equal to 1 gram per milliliter. Notice that how units can combine together. Depending on what type of property we're talking about, units can be multiplied, units can be divided. That's one way of representing the unit. Depending on what your past background might be, you might have also seen things written like this. That milliliters to the negative 1, if you raise something to the negative 1 power, that means 1 over that something. So milliliters to the negative 1 is the same way as saying per milliliter. Whichever way you want to write it, it doesn't matter to me, as long as you are aware how to write density out. So that's our topic of density. Suppose that I tell you this. Let me just look up a number really quickly. So ethanol, that's a pure substance. To refer back to something we talked about on Tuesday, I want to mention its chemical formula. So it has the formula C2H6O, has a density of 0.789 grams per milliliter. So how many grams of ethanol would be in 30 milliliters of ethanol? Well, how could we answer a question like that? Well, we have that density is equal to mass divided by volume. Let me just label this so you know what these refer to. So that's density, volume, and mass. Well, what if we multiply both sides of that equation by volume? Then we're going to get density times volume is equal to mass, which is exactly what we want, because I gave you a density of ethanol. I said how many grams, that's mass, would be in 30 milliliters of ethanol. So we could use this rearranged expression of density to come up with exactly that. So if I've given 30 milliliters of ethanol, and it has a density of 0.789 grams per milliliter. The unit itself has milliliters on the bottom, which means my milliliters are going to cancel out. And so I'm going to end up with grams. So just to multiply it out really quickly, I've got 30 times 0.789, which is going to give me 23.67 grams. Any questions about what we just discussed with density then? Okay, so last section of the first chapter that we're going to cover for now deals with heat and temperature scales. So let me read what your book defines heat as, because there's different ways of expressing it. It says heat is energy on the move. That's a good enough definition, actually. It's amount of energy that's transferred from one object to another. And it's not quite the same thing as temperature. Heat has a specific kind of a unit associated with it, and that would be related to energy. So there's two different units of energy that you need to know about. One is a metric unit of energy, which is the joule. And a joule can be defined in terms of other metric units, which another way to write it is that it is equal to 1 kilogram meter squared per second squared. I'm not going to require you to know that. I just wanted to demonstrate that you can come up with joules from another way. Not to tell the story too long, but it has to do with force and distance. If you put force and distance together, that's work, which is a form of energy. But let me just ask, how many of you have had any kind of physics before? Okay, some of you, but not the whole class. So that's why I'm kind of skimming over this last part. For right now, it's just good enough then you know that the unit of energy is a joule. But there's another unit of energy you're probably more familiar with, which is the calorie, which is abbreviated CAL, and that has a conversion factor of 4.184 joules. That's not a number you need to memorize. If we have unit conversions like this, I'll normally give you those conversions or a quiz or an exam. But I do want to mention this is different from a food calorie. So if you look at the back of your packages of food, 1 calorie with a capital C. So I'll say this is a food calorie. It's actually equal to 1 kilocalorie. So in other words, 1,000 calories. Now, let me tell you that a joule, or calorie actually, the regular calorie, lowercase c, is equal to the amount of energy it would take to take 1 gram of water and heat it up by 1 degree Celsius. And we'll talk about temperature scales in just a second. So that means 1 food calorie is enough energy to take a whole liter of water and heat it up by 1 degree Celsius. So imagine that you have that mega meal that's 1,000 calories. That means you could take 1,000 liters of water with that same amount of energy and heat it up by 1 degree Celsius, just in case that makes you feel any better about your diet. So that's heat. What about temperature? Well, there's 3 scales that you might have heard about before. There's the one that we normally use in the U.S., which is Fahrenheit, which is its own system that we won't use in the lab very much at all. The 2 that we're going to use much more frequently are Celsius and Kelvin. So what's the difference between these scales, the Fahrenheit and Celsius? Well, Celsius is usually abbreviated degrees C, and the way it's defined is based off of the physical properties of water. So some of you might know the answer to this already. If we have the freezing point of water, what is that equivalent to in Celsius? 0 degrees Celsius, that's right. And what about the boiling point of water, the regular boiling point? That's right, it's 100 degrees Celsius. Now, at those same points of boiling and freezing, for Fahrenheit, it turns out to be 212 degrees for the boiling point of water and 32 degrees for the freezing point. In other words, that temperature scale is not based on water. I don't remember the combination of substances without looking it up, but it's some alcohol that was used. And just to give some context why, well, Fahrenheit was a system that was created in Europe where it tends to get awfully cold. So they needed some sort of scale that would measure down below the freezing point of water. So that's just the short version of where did that scale come from. Now, based off these numbers, is there some way to convert back and forth between the two scales? And the answer ends up being yes. So if you look to see that there's 100 degrees between the freezing and boiling points on the Celsius scale, but there's 180 degrees between the freezing and boiling points on the Fahrenheit scale, we have to make an adjustment for the size of the degrees. Also, our starting point for Celsius is 0 versus our starting point for Fahrenheit, which is 32. So here's what the conversion factor would be. If you've already got Fahrenheit and you want to go to Celsius, first you have to take the degrees Fahrenheit and adjust the 0. So you have to take 32 out of it. And then you've got to multiply this by the difference in the size of the scales. So in other words, there's only 100 degrees in the Celsius, but there's 180 in Fahrenheit. Rewriting that the way that it's normally written, that would give us 5/9 degrees Fahrenheit minus 32. If we wanted to go the other way around, we could rearrange this equation. So let's say we've got Celsius already. Well, the Celsius degree is smaller. So to get Fahrenheit, we got to fix the size of the degrees. It would be 9/5 degrees Celsius. And just to say it again, where does this 5/9 or 9/5 comes from? It comes from the difference in size, like I said, between these. So there's 100 degrees difference in the Celsius versus 180 degrees for Fahrenheit. So if you simplify that into a smaller fraction, that's where you get 5/9 or 9/5. So 9/5 Celsius, that fixes the size. But remember, Fahrenheit starts at a different point. So then we have to add 32. Now, you might have an exercise and a quiz where you have to do this conversion, but you're not going to have to memorize these conversions either. Because in the lab, if you measure anything, it's automatically going to be in Celsius. So we don't really do this conversion in lab. So that's why I don't require that you memorize it. But you just want you to be familiar with the formulas, so if you see them on a quiz or exam, you know how to use them. Now, the one conversion you might need to do is to go between Celsius and the other scale that I mentioned, which is Kelvin. Why do we have a third scale if we've already got something that's in terms of 100, a power of 10? Because there's some physical properties that directly depend on temperature, and it wouldn't make physical sense to have negative temperatures then. We need what's known as an absolute scale, where there's a absolute lowest zero, which some of you might have heard that concept before, of absolute zero. That's where the Kelvin scale comes from. So the Kelvin scale is an absolute scale meaning it has a lowest possible temperature, which is listed as 0 Kelvin. Notice there's no degree symbol here. The reason the Celsius and Fahrenheit scales are called degree scales is they're not absolute. 0 for Celsius is defined off of water. 0 for Fahrenheit is defined off of some other substance. But that means those are relative scales. So we use the degree sign for them. Kelvin is a fixed absolute scale. So a Kelvin is just a unit on its own without any kind of degree sign. Now it turns out that 0 degrees Celsius is the same thing as 273 Kelvin, technically 273.15. But in most of the things we do, knowing this 273 number is good enough. So if I wanted to convert between the two scales, if I have Celsius, then Kelvin would be just Celsius plus 273, or Celsius would be Kelvin minus 273. That number is going to come up frequently enough that I do want you to memorize that conversion. I try not to make too many things where you have to memorize, especially in a course like this, but like I said, this is a common enough one that I want you to know it. So those are our three temperature scales. And that's the end of chapter one. So any questions or anything that we did Tuesday or today before we move on to the next chapter? Okay. Now, when you move on to the next chapter, which let me ask, how many of you have even started reading the text? Like, how many of you have started on chapter one already? Ooh. And what about chapter two? So when is your first quiz? Thursday of next week. So that means we're going to be cramming everything over the weekend then? Maybe this is not the most challenging course that you've ever had, especially the material that we've done so far. Although there's a lot of vocabulary there. So you do want to make sure that you stay ahead. So, I mean, is everybody comfortable with the term atom, element, molecule, compound, substance, mixture, all those things we did already? If the answer is yes, then I guess I'll relax. But otherwise, I just want to make sure that you're all staying on track here. Okay, well, when you read chapter two, it gives you a brief historical background to where does our theory of matter, the fact that we talk about atoms, come from. And I'm going to simplify that story a little bit, not because I don't believe in honoring the people that discovered things, but our perspective on that has changed over time. And I'll just say it this way. It's often the people that how to say that in the best way. A lot of times credit is given someone that might be famous, but how did they get famous might be separate from how something got discovered. For example, when I grew up and we learned about DNA, we heard the names Watson and Crick. Watson and Crick, those were the people that supposedly discovered DNA. Who did the measurements that led to that discovery? Happened to be a woman named Rosamond, but that name's not one that we got taught when I was a kid. Why? Because science was a male-dominated discipline. Well, as society has changed and evolved, then our attitudes have changed and evolved as well. So a lot of our stories of science are incomplete. So that's partly why I don't always mention all the names of these discoverers, because history was written by certain people, but maybe that history is not complete. So I like focusing on the science itself. And so I'm not going to make you memorize a bunch of names, except for the ones that are so common, that are so universal, like Dalton's atomic theory. That's a phrase that I would want you to know the name of. But Lavoisier and some of these other names that are mentioned here, I'm just going to tell more of the stories about. So the story, the way that your text starts with, is back in ancient Greece, because I think I already mentioned on Tuesday that the word atom comes from the word atomos, which means uncuttable. And here's where that word comes from, because way back more than 2,000 years ago at this point, there was a philosopher, Leucippus, and his student Democritus, that had this theory of atomic matter. And so the way that the book tells it is, imagine that you're looking at a puddle of water. Well, we know that water can come in little droplets. Well, what if you divide that droplet even smaller and smaller and smaller? Do you reach a point where you can't really divide that water up anymore? And there were two different branches of philosophy, because back then, philosophy, religion, science, they were all kind of mixed together. So these were people trying to wonder about the nature of the universe. And so these two philosophers said, yes, there comes a point where you can't divide anymore. Just like if you look at sand from a distance, it looks like some indefinite mass of material. But if you get up close, you can count out the individual grains of sand. And so that's where this idea of uncuttability came from. That if you get small enough, there's no way to cut these water molecules any smaller. Of course, there was a contrasting theory that no, that matter is this continuum. I mean, how could it be that there's spaces in between matter? Because what would that space be? And for really complicated reasons, it was this other theory of matter, that matter was continuous, that won out for quite a long period of time. Because to talk a little bit about what's not mentioned in the text, we have Aristotle, which I think your book mentions, along with Plato. Well, a lot of that ancient Greek theory was adopted by what became the Catholic Church in Europe, which, of course, that had dominance in Europe for quite a long period of time. And so along with the religious aspect, there was also this proscribed version of what the universe was and how it ticked. And so it was considered heretical to question some of these precepts, like the fact that there weren't such things as atoms. And it was only much later in the 16, 1700s where that authority and that viewpoint really started to get challenged that the idea of the atom came back again. And that's where your textbook picks up again with the mention of some of these people like Priestley and Boyle and Lavoisier. So to tell the story in a little bit different order than what your textbook has, we all know that if we take a piece of paper and burn it, that you're going to end up with less material left over than when you started. And we know from a modern concept the reason why is some of that material was turned into a gas. And of course, if you don't keep that gas in a container, it's going to escape out. So if you took a piece of paper and measured its mass, and then you burned it, and then you measured whatever's left over, of course it's going to look like some of that disappeared. And there was this theory of combustion, of things burning, where they actually had this term called phlogiston, which was thought to be this stuff, which is what caused fire, that would be in some kind of material. So when you burn something, they didn't have the idea that the material was changing. They had the idea that, well, this stuff was somehow being released. But back in the late 1600s, early 1700s, there became more careful measurements. People decided, well, why don't we measure these things? Well, let's try to discover what's really going on. And so to jumble a few experiments together, there came this idea of trying to measure what might be going on, but measure it while it was in some kind of sealed container. So just to draw a picture of what I'm about to discuss, there's this substance, mercuric oxide, which mercury has the abbreviation HG, and mercuric oxide is the substance HGO, so one atom of oxygen per every atom of mercury. And imagine you put this stuff into a container. If you have sunlight that you expose that mercury oxide to, it can decompose and release oxygen gas. So again, if you did this outside of some kind of sealed container, that oxygen gas would just disappear. But someone came up with the idea of putting it in a jar, measuring the whole darn thing before this experiment, and then measuring it afterwards. Well, it turned out that the mass beforehand was the same as the mass afterwards, as long as you kept the jar closed. Now imagine we took that one step further. and maybe you've all seen this before. What would happen if you lit a match and put that latch inside of a sealed container? Eventually would go out, right? Because we know these days it takes oxygen for that match to keep burning. So that's exactly what they did in this case. They took this container, and I don't remember if they thought to do this purposely or if it was by accident, but they ended up lighting a candle, putting it in this container, and they found that it would keep on burning while this stuff was decomposing, which was indirect evidence that, yeah, there was something being released, which eventually got called oxygen. So this experiment showed two things. One, that if you did take into account this stuff that was being released, which we refer to as a gas, then it turned out the mass of that material didn't change, even though you might be changing its form. Indirectly, this was also a discovery that led to the discovery of oxygen. But the main point I want to make is it led to this thing, the law of conservation of mass. Which is this: in a chemical reaction, matter may change form, but you won't change the amount of matter. Put a little bit more formally, in a chemical reaction, matter can change form, but the total amount of matter will not change. Now, that's still mostly true of a chemical reaction, but later on in the quarter, we're going to talk about nuclear processes, in which case that law is no longer quite true. If you take a set of protons and neutrons, and if you were to measure them very carefully, how much mass they have, and then somehow get them to combine together to make an atom, it turns out that mass of the atom will not be the same as the mass of all those protons and neutrons. And it has to do with the energy involved in holding all those particles together. Again, that's a concept we'll come back to later in the quarter. Some of you might have heard of this equation, E equals mc squared, which effectively tells you that mass has some amount of energy content to it. So the law of conservation of mass has to be changed in modern terms to the law of conservation of mass energy, putting mass and energy together. But that's only mostly if we're dealing with nuclear processes. For everything that we're normally going to talk about in this class, this law is still completely true. Now, a separate set of experiments led to another important concept, which is this: the law of definite proportions. If you take water and are somehow able to split it up into its components, into hydrogen and oxygen, you'll find there's always the same amount of hydrogen and the same amount of oxygen in water, no matter where you get that water from. So, in other words, one type of substance, which, remember, our definition of a substance, something that has the same chemical formula throughout. Well, it comes from this law of definite proportions, which says that in a substance, in a pure substance, there will always be a fixed ratio of elements. And as the text points out, this is true whether the substance happens to exist naturally or whether it's artificially created, which, again, hundreds of years ago, that was a novel concept, that you could have something that existed out in nature and you could make exactly the same thing and they would have that same composition. course, that law had to be amended or added to a bit later once the idea or the concept of an atom did start to come about, because it was in the late 1700s, early 1800s, where atomic theory was starting to develop. And so we know that there are these two different molecules, carbon dioxide, which is what you get when you breathe out, you respire. There's also carbon monoxide, something that can be made in combustion, something that if you have a non-electric car, that's why you have this thing called a catalytic converter, something that will take that harmful carbon monoxide and process it before it gets out into the open atmosphere. But that means carbon can combine with oxygen in at least two different ways. And that's the law of multiple proportions. Which is that elements combine in different ratios to form different distinct substances. I'd like to move on now to Dalton's atomic theory. Before I talk about specific experiments that led up to this theory, I would recommend that you all have had the chance to read the chapter first. So I'm just going to talk about the results of the atomic theory, what's listed in your text, and also, as listed in the text, I want to talk about some modern deviations from this theory. So there are four parts of this theory that are mentioned in the text. One is that all matter is composed of these individual, indivisible units known as atoms. And there's two reasons why this is no longer really quite true. We do know that there are ways of dividing atoms up into their individual components. In other words, there are nuclear processes. There's also forms of matter that don't exist properly as atoms. There are a lot of subatomic particles that can combine in some exotic ways. That's even skipping over the fact that there is such a thing known as antimatter. I mean, if you've ever seen Star Trek before, you've heard about how if matter and antimatter can combine, it'll blow up a portion of the universe. Well, that's in fact essentially true. These are two different forms of matter that can annihilate each other to create a puff of energy. So that's not exactly handled in Dalton's theory. Another part of that theory is that elements are specific types of atoms in which all atoms are identical. That's not 100% true either. And the reason is what an element is, how it really behaves chemically, is determined by the number of protons. So I know this may not have come up officially in the book yet, but I introduced on Tuesday how there are three essential particles in an atom. There's the nucleus, which contains protons and neutrons, and around that are the electrons. So protons are what really determine which element that you have. But you can have two atoms of the same element that have different numbers of neutrons. And those are known as isotopes. Have any of you ever heard of carbon dating before? That's where you can assess the age of something by what type of carbon it has. Well, the carbon that mostly makes us up is what's known as carbon-12, where it has 6 protons, 6 neutrons. But there's another form of carbon that's effectively radioactive, you could say. So it's got the same 6 protons, because that's what makes it carbon, but it's got 8 neutrons. So it's a different type of carbon atom, and that's exactly what an isotope is. Maybe you've heard of heavy water before? Anybody ever heard of heavy water? A couple of you? So heavy water, it's still H2O, but it's a different kind of hydrogen called deuterium. That prefix deu means two, and it's from the fact that it has two particles in its nucleus. It's got a proton and a neutron, whereas 99% or so of regular hydrogen just has one proton in it. So D2O, deuterium oxide, is the stuff called heavy water. Again, another example of an isotope. I'm only not writing this down because we have another place in another chapter where we tackle isotopes formally. So I'm just mentioning right now how this theory is not quite true. The next part of this theory is that compounds are formed from fixed ratios of elements. That part's still true. Water is always H2O. Hydrogen peroxide's always H2O2. And the last part of this theory is that in chemical reactions, atoms can rearrange themselves, but the atoms themselves are not changed. And that's essentially true as long as we are only talking about chemical reactions. Again, in nuclear processes, you can actually change the identity of an atom by changing its number of protons or neutrons or, well, we'll get there in a separate chapter, but there are ways you can change the atoms themselves. So let me summarize how the atomic theory is needs a little updating in modern terms. So how will I express that? I'll say that modern atomic theory recognizes that atoms can change. Due to nuclear processes. I'll just say nuclear reactions to make that simpler. But in chemical reactions, atoms do not change. The other part of this that's updated, as I said, is that an element is not just composed of one type of atom. That elements are atoms that all have the same number of protons. But atoms of the same element, which means same number of protons, they can have different numbers of neutrons. And the term for that we'll discuss a little bit later on is isotope. So in other words, there can be isotopes of an element. So that's it for the atomic theory at the moment. Now I want to get to something a little bit more mathematical. Because, as we all know, atoms are really, really tiny objects. So there's a concept known as the mole. And if you've had high school chemistry or maybe even in junior high, you might have heard of a mole before. And I want to try to explain what a mole is. So just some examples of terminology. What does the word dozen mean? 12. So if I say I have a dozen books, that means I have 12 books. What about a baker's dozen? 13. Which, why would that be different? Well, so the baker can eat one of the things that he or she makes to make sure it came out all right. If I say I have a gross of something, how many is that? How much? Is it? I thought it was 20. Oh, wow. It's 12 dozen. Wow, you're right. Okay. Learned something new today. What if you say that you stayed somewhere for a fortnight? That's 2 weeks, 14. The point is, we have all these common terms for numbers that represent some kind of number. If I say I have a trio, that means three. So if I say I have a mole is just a number. Now, I guess writing out four letters is too strenuous, so the abbreviation for mole is M-O-L. But it's equal to the number 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. Now, I'll tell you right now, unless you are a physical chemist or a nuclear chemist, you will almost never, ever, ever use this number in real life. And I mention that because there are lots of problems that are given where you have to convert back and forth between numbers of atoms and a mole, which to me is just a numerical exercise that kind of misses the point of why do we have this number, the mole. But I just want to mention there is this number, 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. Well, where does it come from? That number comes from a unit of measure known as an atomic mass unit. So, okay, I guess I'm going to have to jump around a little bit. I'm going to take a little bit of material from in the future, bring it to today's discussion just to make this make more sense. So let me go ahead and break out and say that isotopes, because I already brought up the term isotope, so let me more formally define it. So isotopes are atoms of the same element with different numbers of neutrons. And let me emphasize yet again, if I say isotopes are atoms of the same element, that means same number of protons with different number of neutrons. And another definition of put on the side here is what's called the mass number. So the mass number for an atom is equal to the number of protons plus the number of neutrons. That's the number 14 if I refer to carbon 14. That 14 is the mass number, meaning number of protons and neutrons. If I say carbon 12, then that means a carbon that's got a total mass number of 12, which, since carbon always has six protons, because the number of protons tell you what element that you have, you can do a simple bit of math to figure out how many neutrons are present. And so the reason I'm telling this side story is because it's directly related to how we define this thing, the atomic mass unit. So one atomic mass unit is defined as, that's why I'm using this triple equal sign, It doesn't just mean equal, it means it's defined as. 1/12 the mass of one atom of carbon-12. Why carbon-12? Well, we're made of carbon, so I guess if we're important, then carbon's important. There may be some deeper scientific reason for that, which I'm not so good with the historical chemistry my own self, so I can try to find out a bit more why it was carbon that was selected. I know that in the past it was oxygen instead, so the definition shifted at one point, and I guess I should do my homework and find out why it shifted. But this is our modern definition, that one atomic mass unit is equal to 1/12 the mass of carbon-12. So that means one atom of carbon-12. Another way to write that symbol is you put the number before the element as a superscript, which means up above the line of text. So one atom of carbon-12 has a mass of exactly 12 AMUs. Well, an AMU, I forget without looking, I think it's 1.67 times 10 to negative 23rd grams. Let's see if I can find that number really quickly. 1.66 times 10 to negative 27 kilograms. It's a tiny, tiny number because we use it to represent the mass of atoms. But we normally operate in grams. And so here's where this 6.022 times 10 to 23rd comes from. That 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd AMUs equals 1 gram. That's where the number comes from. It's a unit conversion number to get you from AMUs to grams. But that's why this is called a mole, to come up with some kind of word like dozen or whatever other example words you want. Something to refer easily to that number. So one mole of AMUs is equal to 1 gram, which means one AMU is 1 gram divided by a mole. You might think, well, what's the point? The point is when we go and do chemical reactions occur on the basis of the number of atoms, not on the basis of their mass. That's an important enough sentence. I'm going to write that out. Chemical reactions occur on the basis of numbers of atoms, not on their mass. So, for example, if I had hydrogen and oxygen, let's say that I had 3 molecules of hydrogen. And let's say, let's make it 4. And let's say that I had 2 molecules of oxygen. Why am I writing those circles out in pairs? Well, because that's the way these elements naturally occur. That hydrogen out in the open atmosphere is almost always H2. Oxygen out in the open atmosphere, except for ozone, is usually O2. If I combine these things together, you've got to make sure you've got enough hydrogens and enough oxygens to create water. And it takes exactly 2 hydrogens per oxygen in order to come up with a molecule of water. So if I'm doing a chemical reaction and I don't want to end up with an excess of something, or if I don't want to end up where I'm missing something, I have to balance this number of atoms. So if I take 4 H2s and if I take 2 O2s, I'm going to be able to make 4 H2Os, which this is not very formally done, but that's effectively our first chemical reaction equation. Since I've mentioned that term, again, it's coming up later, but it helps to have a little terminology just to get somewhere. So we call the what's on the left-hand side here the reactants, and on the other side here we have the products, and the arrow means that you're converting from the reactants to products. So the point of this example is if you count up the number of hydrogens and count up the number of oxygens, that's the right number for this reaction to occur. Now, what if I said this instead? If I give you 20 grams of hydrogen and 18 grams of oxygen, how much water are you going to be able to make? Well, that would be exactly like this. Let's say I give you 2 pounds of bread and I give you a pound of cheese. How many sandwiches can you make? Let's say that was a legitimate question. Here's 2 pounds of bread. Here's a pound of cheese. How many sandwiches? What do you have to know in order to be able to answer that question? Well, how many slices of bread have you got? Sure, you got 2 pounds of it, but how many pieces are there? Because if you assume that a sandwich has got 2 pieces of bread, and I just say you got 2 pounds, well, you don't know how many pieces of bread that you got. Same thing with the cheese. How thick do you slice it? How much is each slice of cheese going to be in terms of weight? Same thing goes on with hydrogen and oxygen. One oxygen atom is 16 times the mass, roughly, of one hydrogen atom. So if all I give you is masses, you don't know how many numbers of things are running around. And so that's why we have to count according to numbers. Again, back to the statement. Chemical reactions occur on the basis of numbers of atoms, not necessarily on their mass. Now, if 1 gram of hydrogen has roughly 6.022 times 10 to 23rd atoms in it, that's an awfully big number to have to carry around. That's why we have the word mole. Because what I could say to turn this equation around, I could say that 4 moles of H2 react with 2 moles of O2 to produce 4 moles of water. I could replace the word mole with dozen. 4 dozen H2s react with 2 dozen oxygens to make 2 dozen molecules of water. I could say pairs, trios, quartets, whatever term you want to. The fact is this ratio of numbers is always the same. So why do we use the number mole? Because it's convenient. That's the reason why we use it. So the whole point of this section of the chapter is it introduces the concept of a mole. So anytime we measure something out, we're going to have something known as the molar mass. That is the mass of 1 mole of, how do I want to phrase that? Of a substance. It could be just hydrogen, it could be water, it could be anything with a fixed chemical formula. Now let me see how far this chapter goes with this concept. Oh, it actually gets into that. Okay, so how do we calculate molar mass? So if you look at the periodic table, which is the last section of this chapter, the table that we have in the room here is kind of a common example of how the table is laid out. You have the elemental symbols. Remember, those are the letters that are used to represent the name of each type of element. On this table, on the upper right-hand corner, that's the number of protons. So remember that we do arrange the table in terms of number of protons. There's an exception to that that I'll explain when we have the time to do it. But if you look at the top half of the table, at least, it's all in numerical order. And then down below each element on this particular table, you see in red written a number. So that is what's called the atomic mass. Now, what's the unit of measurement that's given there? That's AMUs, if you're talking about one atom, or it's grams, if you're talking about moles. How can it be that we use the same number for two different units of measurement? It's exactly this thing right here, that if we have 1 mole worth of something, that's how we get to grams. That's why the numbers end up being the same if we're using AMUs for atoms or moles if we're talking about grams. So let me just put into the notes here, carbon. So the way that it's written on this periodic table, its atomic number of protons, again, is in the upper right, and it's got 12.011 written down below there. Okay, so let me address something else. And I know I'm starting to get a little more technical, but hey, chemistry is a technical thing. How come this number is not exactly 12? No, in this case, electrons are really tiny. They are about 1, to round the number off, about 1/2,000th the mass of a proton or a neutron. Yeah. Because there's not all carbon atoms are exactly the same. I mentioned earlier that there's such a thing as carbon-14. There's such a thing as carbon-13. So this atomic mass represents the average of all the isotopes of carbon. And that's important enough that let me write that out. So atomic mass, that is the mass of one atom of a carbon, of an atom, or 1 mole. I'll write that out in just a moment. But the atomic mass listed on the periodic table represents an average of all isotopes of an element. And that number is technically different in different parts of the planet. If you go mine a bunch of carbon from, let's say, Russia versus the U.S. versus somewhere in Africa, because of the way the planet formed or whatever occurred over time, there might be slightly different ratios of the different isotopes in different parts of the planet. And that means that these really are averages. If you had to do way more precise work, if the numbers really mattered, then you have to look up and find out what truly the atomic mass would be in that region. That's a concept that's not normally mentioned in an introductory class, and it's not listed anywhere on the periodic table, but it's true. So some periodic tables don't just have a number like this, they have a range. But for first year chemistry, we just got to get on with life. And so we come up with these reasonable averages that in everyday work just fine. So back to what I originally said, this is an average of different isotopes. So let me say the other thing that I mentioned is that this mass is in terms of AMUs for one atom and grams for 1 mole, which remember that a mole is just a number. So what's the practical? How do we use these things? Well, I said earlier that if we want water and hydrogen to react correctly, we have to have the right numbers of atoms. And so suppose then I said that given 20 grams of oxygen and 16 grams of hydrogen, how many moles of oxygen and hydrogen are present? And so back to something I mentioned at the very beginning of lecture, the unit conversion factor. We're going to need some kind of factor to come up with converting from grams to moles. So if we look on the periodic table, each oxygen, if you round it off, is 16.0 grams per mole. And then if we look on the table again for hydrogen, one hydrogen atom is 1.01 grams per mole. So that means the molar mass of O2 is 32 grams per mole, and the molar mass of H2 is 2.02 grams per mole. I just multiplied what each atom's mass would be by the number of atoms in that substance. So O2 has two oxygens, which is why I multiply by two. H2 has two hydrogens, which is why I multiplied by two. So look at my units. It's grams per mole. So how am I going to come up with moles? Well, for oxygen, I had 20 grams of oxygen. And so if I want to end up with moles, I better make my conversion factor with moles on top. Now, for oxygen, it's 32 grams per mole. Grams is going to go on the bottom because that's the only way it's going to cancel. The 32 goes on the bottom because that goes with grams. It's 32 grams per one mole. So if I multiply that out, I get 20 32nds, which is 10 16ths, which is 5H, which is 0.625 moles of oxygen. Similar thing we do with hydrogen. I'm given 16 grams of hydrogen. We know that in each mole of hydrogen, there's 2.02 grams. And so doing that number out, 16 divided by 2.02, and rounding off a little bit, we get 7.92 moles of hydrogen. Now, where could we use these numbers? Well, suppose I put this much oxygen together and this much hydrogen together. Is all of it going to react to give me water? No, because I need one oxygen, one O2, for every two hydrogens. I got way more hydrogen than I have oxygen. So I can look at that number of moles and say, okay, this chemical reaction is not going to go completely. I'm going to have something left over. But I'm able to say that because I'm looking at numbers. Moles are numbers. So the fact I converted this into moles is how I can tell if this reaction is going to go completely successfully or not. If all I had was mass, there would be no way to tell. And that's the whole point of the mole concept. Now, this is a little bit beyond what's mentioned in chapter 2, but we get very quickly back to it in a future chapter. So to try to make the topic make more sense, that's why I stepped forward a little bit. But like I said, you're going to have the chance over the weekend to read and see what really is in chapter 2. So before I move on, does anyone have any questions? Yes. This is in chapter 2. So chapter 2 does show you what a mole is. It does show you what a molar mass is. It shows you how to go from grams to moles. The thing the chapter, I don't think... Oh, actually, it does. I missed it. It actually does mention what an atomic mass unit is. So, no, actually, the chapter does go over most of what we did here. Yes? They will be as soon as we're done. So in other words, I don't have, this is a different textbook than the last time I taught the course. So the notes that are generated now are very different than the time that I taught before. So after each lecture, while I'm in office hours, I will process the notes and post them to the website, which if you are already registered for the course, you should, and even if you were on the wait list for the course, you should already have the link to the website. I can give you the website link after class, and anybody else that might be trying to add in. Now, we have just a few minutes left, and let me start mentioning the last main topic of the chapter, which is this thing called the periodic table. So I'm going to do sort of a cartoonish picture of the table. And again, I'm going to be jumping forward a little bit to explain, well, where does this shape of the table come from and what is the table used for? So here's the story that you're going to hear in a few weeks. You've got the nucleus that's got the protons and the neutrons. You've got the electrons that are arranged around the nucleus. There's a very specific way that electrons tend to be arranged around the nucleus. And to simplify the story for right now, if I've got an atom that's got the nucleus in the center, if I imagine that electrons are orbiting around in circles, which they don't, but that's, we got to start somewhere, then the closest circle into the atom can only hold a maximum of 2 electrons. Why? That comes later. But the next circle around can hold a maximum of 8 electrons. And if you've had chemistry before, you might have heard about this thing, the octet rule. Octet meaning 8, meaning that somehow atoms are favorable when they've got 8 electrons in their outer shell. If you count the main columns, the what's called the main group elements, so these 2 columns on the left, these 6 columns on the right, those are called main group elements. And if you count the columns, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them. It's directly tied to this octet rule. So where an element goes on the periodic table depends on its number of protons. But how that element behaves chemically is related to its number of electrons. And if you have something like hydrogen, which is sitting up here alone on the periodic table, and there's a reason for that we'll get to, if we wanted to draw this sort of fake picture of what hydrogen looks like, it's only got 1 little electron in it. So if hydrogen reacts and loses its 1 electron, then it will turn into H+, because it's missing a negative charge. Well, it turns out everything in this same column, lithium, sodium, potassium, rubidium, cesium, everything in this column tends to make things that end up +1 charge. Just like the next column over, Be, beryllium, Mg, magnesium, Ca, calcium. All of those are elements that tend to end up with a +2 charge when they react. Skipping over to this other main group column, aluminum and its family tend to make +3 charges. Now, why am I telling you this? Because every time you go across the row, the properties repeat. So using a more mathematical term, the properties are periodic. They keep happening the same way over and over again. And there were different people in the 1800s that recognized this was true, that elements had certain common behaviors to them. And so they arranged the elements according to their behavior, not just the charges that they would make, but the types of compounds they would make as well. On the other side of the periodic table, we have helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon. Those are things that don't normally react. So they tend to end up without any charge. The compound sodium chloride. Sodium tends to make a plus charge, chloride is a negative one charge, which is the same thing that the other things in that column tend to make. And like I'm probably repeating a bunch, we're going to learn why they have these charges later on. But just to explain what the periodic table is, it's an arrangement of atoms that have common properties with each other.